Coming up on this week's book show, from the best-selling author of a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, The Circle, A Hologram for the King, and What is the What, comes a taut, suspenseful story of two visitors' role in a nation's fragile peace. Dave Eggers' latest is The Parade, a novel. Dave Eggers on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. From the best-selling author of a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, The Circle, A Hologram for the King, and What is the What, comes a taut, suspenseful story of two visitors' role in a nation's fragile peace. An unnamed country is leaving the darkness of decades at war, and to commemorate the armistice, the government commissions a new road connecting two halves of the state. Two men, foreign contractors, are sent to finish the highway. One is flighty and incautious. The other wants only to do the work and go home. Both men must eventually face the absurdities of their positions and the dire consequences of their presence. The name of the new novel is The Parade, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dave Eggers to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the beginnings of The Parade. What brings you to want to write about the subject of building a road and putting these two halves together?
The genesis of it was maybe 15 years ago. Well, let me think. Let's think of the math. When it was 2006. I was in South Sudan with Valentino Achak Deng, who was the protagonist of What is the What you just mentioned. And we saw in rural South Sudan a giant road being built in the middle of the forest, and they were leveling villages left and right to make way for it. And it wasn't being built by a Sudanese company or even Ugandan or Kenyan or anybody or any logical contractor. It was being built by a Swedish team, and all the Swedish equipment had been brought all the way to South Sudan. I can't imagine the expense and the trouble to get it there. And it struck me as just so odd, incongruous, and even absurd that they would contract with a Scandinavian company to build a road connecting two parts of the country. And since then, I became sort of obsessed with finding and sort of examining the role of contractors, whether it's a Chinese team building a railroad in Nigeria or Pakistan or Canadian company helping to build a port in Malaysia, whatever it is. I'm always fascinated with the role of these somewhat disinterested workers abroad that are building these infrastructure projects that might be used for benign or enlightened purposes and might have nefarious consequences, and sort of what their awareness is of it and their complicity is.
The protagonist in this novel, the two main characters, have just numbers for names. They do that to not complicate things any further than they are already complicated. The protagonist, 4, comes in, and he has a lot of miles behind him in the sense that he has been doing many of these projects. I assume, much like he is doing in this novel, working the machinery and creating roads and being a foreign contractor.
He might as well be working in Fresno or, you know, upstate New York. It's about the paving. It's about the work and the integrity of the road itself. That's all he cares about. He doesn't care where he is or what the, you know, geopolitical situation is. He wants to make the schedule, do the work well, and leave. But his counterpart, 9, This is his first job. You know, he sees it as an adventure. He sees his role as having an elasticity to it, you know, like sure, he's supposed to help remove objects from the road and make sure the paver can get through unimpeded. But anyone that he encounters, he wants to know, and those that he thinks he can help, he naively and recklessly dives in. And so one of them, four, is just about, you know, has kind of blinders on, I guess, and doesn't look left or right, no peripheral vision. And nine is sort of the opposite, without any boundaries. And both of them sort of have complicated effects, I guess, to either position.
Well, what I liked about them is they both make sense, in the sense of we all know people who perhaps travel for work. And then there's the person who says, oh, when I go, I'll go to work from 9 to 5, but then afterwards I'm going to go see the city, I'm going to go out, I'm going to rent a car, I'm going to go see everything. And then there's the other people who go in and are in Cincinnati, and they're just going to be in Cincinnati, do their work, and get out of town.
Yeah.
Both of those make sense.
They both make sense. And that was the hope, is that I'm really interested in characters that there's no right way to engage. I don't think either one of them has consequences. Either one of them you can sympathize with or identify with, and neither is perfect. Both approaches to travel or work can have implications that are far beyond your imagining. It's the same, like you said, like even if it's domestic travel, there are both ways to engage, and both of them, whenever you engage, whenever you get off the path, it can get complicated quickly, whether it's sort of like Ray Bradbury butterfly effect kind of idea, or whether it's how it is if an NGO worker, you see this, you know, I've seen this in all parts of the world among the NGO class, where you have seasoned staffers in developing countries that are really about the work and they're really all business and their mission is very circumscribed. And then you see this sort of, and tends to be the newer workers, the newer staffers who are missing curfew and hard to find sometimes, and they engage and complicate their own lives and the lives of the people that they run into. And there's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with that, but that recklessness can sometimes have far-reaching consequences. But in both cases, humility, I think, is necessary for either role, you know? And in this case, four and nine, neither one of them really has that kind of curiosity mixed with humility that maybe makes for a better result.
Dave Eggers is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Parade. Once the road is completed, the idea is to have the parade, which is a celebration, I would assume.
Yeah, the people that commissioned the work are from the northern capital of the country, and this country is the north and south has been at war for decades. And the president of the country, based in the northern capital, has seemingly done a enlightened or salutary sort of project by building this road that would connect the north and the south and bring medicine and progress and, you know, commerce to the south. And to celebrate that, yeah, the minute that the road is finished, there will be a parade going from north to south. And so that's why they're on the clock. They're trying to make the schedule. And nine, who's the more chaotic of the two, is constantly doing things to compromise this. The schedule and the work itself, and even, you know, their ability to complete it, is constantly being threatened by this, you know, incautiousness on the part of nine, and the fact that he's unfindable and he's always getting himself in trouble and he's engaging with, you know, having an affair with local woman and then being, you know, put in jail for this by the local police and giving away essential parts of their operation, meaning, you know, their radio and their helmets and their, you know, vehicles, and losing all of these things. And ultimately, four is just all about getting the schedule, meeting it, and being able to be ready for this parade. But ultimately, the motives of this government that commissioned them are beyond their contemplation.
I have to ask the question just because it dawned on me, or I was thinking about it as I was reading the novel, which is, I wonder if the idea of a Trump parade had anything to do with
Well,
this.
There's a commonality for sure in that, to some extent, there's an authoritarian streak in a lot of parades. You know, they are the favorite kind of celebration of an authoritarian. So there's no surprise that Trump would be a lover of parades. And you know, this is in the parade, we're talking about an authoritarian regime too. But, you know, the other overlap was I was almost done with the book when about a year ago I got a tour of Homeland Security and the Border Patrol and gave tours to journalists of the Trump wall samples down in San Diego. Mm. And I went down there and I didn't expect there to be much overlap, but here you had another sort of debatable vanity project of an authoritarian-leaning person. We, you know, the Border Patrol people were very open and really candid, and it was very encouraging just to see them and meet them and to know any question we had, we could ask. And all these guys, about half of them were Mexican-American police officers or, you know, Border Patrol officers who really had a very nuanced view on the border and enforcement of border security. So they were so open, but the one group that we were not allowed to interview or even photograph were the contractors that were built the wall samples. And they were sort of furtively in the distance, kind of hiding behind the walls because they didn't want to be, you know, their picture in the paper as part of such a politically fraught project. And it overlaps so directly with the pavers, too, who are sort of like, listen, this is a paycheck. I don't want to be involved in the larger implications or the geopolitics of this. I want to do the work because I'm a mason, I'm an engineer, or I'm a welder, an oil engineer, whatever, or a paver, and I want to go home. But I'm always fascinated. I wish I could have interviewed these guys because to me, they were the most interesting people on that San Diego desert that day.
One of the things that I found fascinating in reading is that as I started in, I thought, oh, well, these are Americans. They're the ones doing the work. They've come to this country. They're Americans. Then I realized as I start reading closely that there no countries are named. The country the book is set in isn't named. The nationality of the contractors isn't named. I don't know. And I assume that that was very conscious.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm an American, and this is being published in the U.S. first, and so that would be the natural assumption. But I wanted to try to, as best as I could, denationalize it, both from the point of view of the contractors and the country that where they're working, because this is something that's it's universal. And, you know, again, this was based on a pair of Swedish guys I saw in the South Sudanese wilderness, you know, and I wanted to say, you know, there are infrastructure projects going on all over the world right now that have the most unusual combinations, whether it's Filipino workers in Saudi Arabia, you know, building ports and roads and railways there, or whether it's Chinese engineers building a railroad in Nigeria or a port in Pakistan, like, everywhere you go, this dynamic is at play. I also wanted to sort of say, listen, we're not the only ones that are engaged abroad, and we're not I think that the liberal side of this country, and I count myself in that group, we always think it's us that are doing these things, whether it's, soft power, economic imperialism, real imperialism, you know, or classic imperialism, whatever it is, we always think it's us. We think we're the culprit. But we have to expand our view a bit and know that we are not at all the only ones that are sort of working abroad with possible ulterior motives. Or in the case of like the Swedish team in South Sudan, with no motives maybe at all. They're there just to do the project and go home. And so I didn't want it to fall into a familiar rubric of American intervention abroad. It really is, I think, hopefully more nuanced than that. And also, I didn't want it to be just about a global superpower exploiting locals, because in this case, who's exploiting who? You know, like, this is one of the questions that I wanted to take on in the book, is that we go in because we're Americans. We just assume that we are the exploiters always. I think I do. I just assume that we are at fault sometimes. And so as much as I am believing in, you know, the good effects and the, you know, the positive effects of some interventions, at the same time, I do think that we've so often come in ignorantly and we've done more harm than good. But in this case, it's much more complicated than, you know, American clumsiness abroad. Mm.
Dave Eggers is the author of the new novel, The Parade. You mentioned nuance a moment ago, and I thought of something that, as I was reading early in the novel, the machine, the paver that Four runs is an RS-80. And there is an explanation. You explain the difference. This is a brand new machine, and it's yellow in color, so we can relate to that too, because most of our machines are of that color. It is an RS-80. It's a souped-up model of the RS. It's the better model than the RS-50. The RS-50 has room for two people. The RS-80, which is the new fancy one, only has room for one person. That seems to be saying something to me.
You know what's funny is I had the idea for the book early on. I thought, well, you know, usually a paving team is like, it could be up to like 10, 12 vehicles,
right,
and dozens of people. And I said, well, I can't, that's not the kind of book I wanted to write. I wanted it to be really reduced to these two guys and two perspectives. And I actually went online, I looked around, I did a lot of research about paving, and I found, and you can find it on YouTube too, Volvo, I think it was Volvo, put a prototype, or at least they have a design for a prototype of a paver that only uses one person. And I was so, you know, thrilled to find this like all-in-one machine. So I actually, you know, it's the design of the machine in the book is really based on this prototype that I found, because I wanted to isolate the one paver, Four, to have him in a bubble. He's literally in a glass bubble where he can not smell, see, you know, hear anything outside of the, you know, the straight black line in front of him and the work ahead coming to a pinpoint on the horizon. And then meanwhile, his partner has to be out and about and has to be, you know, going up and down the road, mitigating obstacles, that kind of a thing. And so just to heighten or underline, I guess, the contrast between the two approaches to passing through a foreign land.
There is an especially moving scene in the book. It comes fairly early, maybe about a third of the way through, where we've seen Four, and he's in that bubble, as you mentioned, and he's dealing with his colleague, Nine, who is all over the place, and he's trying to keep him under control. And then he sees a boy, and the boy won't move, and he has to pick up the boy. And he suddenly has to interact. And I just thought that was fascinating.
Well, this is maybe the first time in Four's career, and he's been doing this for years all over the world, where he really had to, no choice, because of the incompetence and of his partner, who should have been the one to make sure that this boy wasn't standing on the road. He has to stop the paver, shut it down, which has its own complications, and actually try to think about what to do with this boy. And instantly, he goes through all the steps that he always knew he should not do, should not pick up this child that he doesn't know, whose parents are not present, should not try to reunite this child with his parents. But instantly, he finds himself just that going down that very slippery slope so quickly, where he says, well, he gets an indication from the boy that he lives in one direction, so he takes him down the road embankment and toward a forest, and then he's halfway through the forest when he realizes it's mined, and he sees the sign that says, you know, don't walk through here. This is a heavily mined forest, and he realizes that within minutes of engaging, he is endangering the life of this boy because of his rashness, because of his good intentions, maybe because of his recklessness. All of these things. And he just curses himself for breaking every rule that he knew never to break. You know, that scene is really important, and probably the first scene I wrote, because it mirrors some experiences that I've had abroad, and I know it's something that NGO workers are always grappling with. How to engage and what engagement is right, what engagement is helpful. Can you ever go in so quickly and try to help a situation without knowing the larger context, and how quickly and catastrophically it can go wrong, especially in a post-conflict zone like this. And so that's when things go off the rails, so to speak, and they never quite get back, or it takes a long time for to get back onto the straight and narrow. We have to avoid all these road metaphors, don't we?
Yeah, you know, it's inevitable, I think. Yeah. You write, "He placed the boy's tiny feet, light as a newborn's deer, on the new asphalt and stepped back. The boy looked around as if orienting himself, and then he looked to Four as if knowing Four would be leaving. He made no complaint." And then you write about how Four responds to that, and he gags and understands his closeness to death. And as you say, that's really when everything starts to the realization that things can go wrong.
Yeah, he has almost never stepped out of his pod before. And he has other things to live for. He's got a family. He wants to get home. And so I think it's understandable, and I think, as you know, the hope is that the reader can identify slowly, maybe, but eventually, with his point of view, which is his role is not to reunite this boy with his family, who ultimately the boy is not lost. The boy knows where he is, and he's, you know, just happened to be standing there. But the Four maps his ideas onto the boy. He assumes that this kid is lost. He assumes he can be the one to reunite him. All of these things that ultimately come from a good place, but he is doing a lot of sort of cultural mapping onto him and deciding what might be best for him. And I think that, yeah, afterward, because he was so close to death and so close to killing them both, he is just overwhelmed for maybe the first time in all of these years of work doing this. He's overwhelmed by, you know, the catastrophic implications of making the wrong move. And of course, it's so heightened. I mean, I don't mean to say that every time we go abroad, like, it's that fraught for all of us. We shouldn't shake hands with somebody or whatever. But I wanted to sort of heighten everything and take it to its logical extreme and sort of, you know, highlight everything in a— the landscape is so blank, it's supposed to, you know, have a surreal and sort of, existential sort of landscape to sort of, so where you can isolate these situations, these few situations where so few characters interact, and that you can take them to their logical extreme.
At the beginning of our conversation, and I'd just like to come back to that, because you were talking about the inspiration and the catalyst of being your trip to the South Sudan. You weren't traveling by road, you were flying, but you still get that sense.
Well, once you're in South Sudan, I mean, it's a little different now, but at that time, we got in through with a cargo plane that was carrying aid into the country. But at that time, South Sudan had very few paved roads. But you fly in, and usually there's a dirt airstrip in a lot of towns, and they do one pass to get rid of the goats, because the goats are grazing on the airstrip, and then they run either way, and then you swing around again and you land on the dirt airstrip. And then after that, you can get by in a car, but it's dirt road, so during the rainy season it's so deeply rutted and that it'll take you hours to go a few miles in some cases. But but this is what's happening in South Sudan all over, is that, you know, the Chinese are so interested in the oil, and they have this sort of long-term oil partnership, that they are creating the infrastructure in the country, slowly but surely. But they're the ones that are building the roads, the pipelines, the railways, so that they can get the oil out. And whether or not any of this is benefiting the average citizen of South Sudan is a matter of great debate, who ultimately is seeing any of this money from all the oil, and are the Chinese at all interested in, you know, the power struggles that have been going on since South Sudanese independence? I'm not so sure. I don't know if I answered your question or if I just went way off
topic. No, you very much answered my question, because even with the case in this book where the war has ended and this is the road that is bringing these two halves together, there's also the realization, even along the way, that the war really never stopped or stops.
You know, it's South Sudan, but so many countries, especially the newer countries, there's so many long-standing divisions that are not so easily solved, or deep-seated rivalries, conflicts, economic motivations. So often these the new country or a new administration or a new form of government, we think, oh, well, it's all going to be fine now. You know, they have a constitution. It's not so easy. You know, countries are born in fits and starts, and you do have to spend decades sometimes sort of extinguishing all these old rivalries. And a lot of times the old leadership and the those in power and the rebellion, they have to die off, because otherwise these things don't go away. And I think it's not unique to that country or so many, but in the meantime, yeah, who do these projects benefit? You know, like and who's using who again? You know, I'm fascinated by this new port being built by the Chinese in Pakistan that it's part of the, you know, China's Belt and Road project, and it's, you know, a project that probably Pakistan might not undertake without the Chinese help, but it's going to benefit Pakistan in the short term. But ultimately, you know, if China decides to convert this from a maritime sort of a merchant port to a military asset, they could do that, turn that on a dime. And ultimately, is Pakistan, you know, prepared for that conversion? Are they aware of it? Or is this a calculated risk that they're taking? And I think it's so interesting always. These projects have to be taken on sometimes for short-term development, even while the local governments know of the larger eventual risk, you know, that that they are giving sometimes a larger power like China power over, you know, geopolitical power in the future. So I am really fascinated by China's moves. I got to say, they are doing stuff at a speed and a scale that I don't know if it's has any precedent.
The name of the new novel is The Parade. It is published by Knopf. Dave Eggers, I can't thank you enough for joining us. What a great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks so much, Joe. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Dave Eggers' new novel is The Parade. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.